Did you grow up in California?
No, I'm from Buffalo. And actually, I went to Harvard. My first job out of college was at the board. I was at the board, and then was for, I guess, a year and a half or 2 years in the international division.
So when would that have been?
It wasn't a division. You know, it was just a small thing. That was 39. What happened was I had talked to them during the spring of 39, but I was had another thing to do in Washington, so I wasn't in any hurry. Then when war broke out in Europe, they decided they'd better get more people in the division to follow what was happening in Europe. And so they sent me a wire, please come as soon as possible. So I came in the middle of September of 39.
So you had trained at Harvard?
As an undergraduate. Yeah.
So when you went to the board, you had a BA degree.
Right.
Had you studied economics at Harvard?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have any of the names at Harvard?
Yeah. Well, I worked with Hanson and Williams. I'd taken their undergraduate and graduate courses. Mm-hmm. And I knew Seymour Harris.
A very large fraction of the people who ended up in the system were trained by Harris and Williams and Hanson at Harvard, a very illustrious group of people. I suppose they inculcated an interest in policy, and
right.
Of course it must have been an exciting time to be a student in economics.
Yeah.
Did you read Keynes's General Theory at that time?
Just, as I say, in Hanson's graduate course, there were, the book had just come out by six young guys there at Harvard, and we read that. I didn't read the general theory itself, but I forget what they called the six Harvard economists, which was the first sort of simplification of the general theory.
Who was running research and international at the board at that time? The names
Walter Gardner was very small. Walter Gardner was there, and Chan Morris was his deputy. And the day I came in, Bill Salant and George Yossi left. That was why they needed me right away. They were going back to, Bill went back to Harvard, and I think George did too. And I shared a office with Andy Kmark, and that was the four of us were the only four economists in the international division at that point. And then very soon Bert Knapp came in, and then Charlie Kindleberger came in. But as I say, the first 4 or 5 months I was there, there were just four people in the international part.
Did you have any contact with the economists who were so important by the 50s, Riefler and Thomas, Ralph Young?
Not really. I knew Goldwasser, who was head of the division.
Mm-hmm.
I had some contact with him, and with Emile Ducre, and somebody else who went over to the White House with Curry. And I can't think of.
Lawton Curry?
Yeah.
Oh, so you knew him?
He was working with Emile Ducre. That was the early work on GNP and things like that.
Did you have any contact with Treasury at that point?
Andy Kmark left the board to go over as a special assistant to Morgenthau, and so I saw him and knew a few other people that we'd see occasionally. I don't remember anymore.
So, even by that time, much of the technical expertise in Washington resided at the Board of Governors.
Right. On business cycle stuff. Not so much on monetary. It was much stronger in terms of other things. Then just as I was leaving to go into the Army, the international division sprouted with all sorts of people. I think Triflin and people like that came, but that was after. While I was there, as I say, Gardner, Morse, mm-hmm. Knapp, and Kindleberger were the only ones.
So later on, did you maintain contact with, I know you had a very active interest in international in the 60s, so did you make contact with Triffin and Kindleberger
as I was finishing my Army career, since it looked like I was going to be stuck for a long time, I went back to Washington to see what was happening, and Kindleberger was forming the German-Austrian division in the State Department. And to handle reparations, so I went to work for him. But actually, I was in Washington for 2 or 3 months waiting to get out of the Army and backing up the reparations conference. And he, John DeWilva, and the guy who was later went to Texas.
Rostow?
Yeah, Rostow was Kindleberger's assistant at that point. As I say, I worked with them for about three months. Then I went to Brussels for a year with the negotiations on reparations and also the so-called gold pot. And then, but I had planned it only for a year because I wanted to go back and get a degree.
So you already had a practical knowledge of economics by the time you went back,
I worked as an economist for about 2.5 or 3 years. I was 5 years in the Army.
Where were you in the Army?
I started out as an infantryman, and eventually I was an ordnance officer and a base ordnance.
In
Air Force, Albuquerque. When I was attached to going overseas, but then they got the war as a group ordnance officer.
Where did you go back to school?
Harvard.
And you studied under the same group of individuals, Williams and Hanson, anything?
Right, in fact, I was the I and Minsky were their section, and the two of us were the section, and for Hanson and Williams.
And
I wrote my dissertation under Mason and Hanson.
How much Keynesian economics did Williams teach in his courses as opposed to institutional detail about the international monetary situation?
I can still remember how mad some people were because he was a sort of an agnostic or skeptic with respect to economics. And there were people who felt, graduate students who felt strongly that anybody who was that much of a skeptic oughtn't to teach a graduate course. If you were going to teach, you ought to teach something and not...
You ought to really believe.
not simply be a skeptic.
So I've associated him with Keynesian ideas, but he was skeptical of any received...
doctrine. You had to be cautious and so on. He was still commuting half-time in New York as head of the research division of the bank, and half-time in Cambridge.
He continued his relationship with the New York Fed for a long time, didn't he?
I think virtually totally retired. Mm-hmm.
And so from Harvard you went to?
I came out to Berkeley. Mm-hmm.
So what year was that?
I came to Berkeley in 48.
And so you remained at Berkeley until you became a governor?
Yeah. But what happened was I was interested in construction and housing. From the board, I was interested in the business cycles.
Right.
And it seemed to me that construction was a part of the business cycle that had never been, didn't get its due, that it was more important, that nobody was studying it and so on. So Berkeley was setting up a program in real estate and urban economics in the business school. And I came out, the two of us started it, really.
You and?
A fellow named Paul Wendt.
Did you consult with the SNL industry was growing very rapidly in California in the 50s and 60s,
so
you didn't consult with them?
Actually, I did a major study, and actually, I don't have to be modest, it's the best that was ever done on the house building industry. I got the first big grant from HUD. I was their first research grant they gave, I think. It was a major study of the house building industry. It's still, I think, pertinent about what the industry is like. But as part of that, I got to know the people in that industry fairly well. But also, we had an advisory group, and it included the head of the Mortgage Bankers Association, the head of the National Association of Realtors, and so on. Because California was very active in all of those groups. So I did that, but I did some, we didn't do much consulting. I did one major project on the SNL just before I went to the board.
So when you went to the board, you had no idea how important housing was going to be in 66, and that was just fortuitous that you would be in the center of...
No, it wasn't fortuitous,
So you were chosen because of your interest?
Well, it's a more complicated thing than that, if you want to know. Well, anyway, so I all the time I was Berkeley, my field was housing and macroeconomics. Uh-huh. And in somewhere around, I'm trying to think what the timing is now, 61 or 62, when computers were just coming in, Larry Klein and Jim Dusenberry and others got the idea that you could now build a major model of the economy. That was the so-called Brookings model.
Right.
There were about 25 or 30 of us, but I, in fact, had the construction and rent part of that model. So
that was already at Berkeley when you were doing that?
Yeah, I was doing that from Berkeley.
And then the people at the board later on who worked at that, like DeLue, did you know any of those people at that
DeLue moment? DeLue was brought in. The board's representative of the group originally was Dan Brill.
Right.
And Dan realized that neither he nor the board knew enough about what was happening in any kind of metrics to be able to offer much. So he hired DeLue to really represent the board in the model. This is my memory. These things have to be checked fairly carefully. But
No, I've actually talked with DeLue.
He told you?
Yeah.
So he did the monetary section, as I say. I forget the guy from the council, but the academics were appalled at how little the people from Washington knew at that time.
Yeah, for a while Goldfeld was at the council, and I think maybe he worked on Stephen Goldfeld.
No, I
think Duisenberry, of course, later was a member of the council.
But Dan Brill realized that the board didn't have to go, and that brought in DeLue and so on. So I had been working on econometrics and model building and stuff at Berkeley, but as part of the Brookings project. That was about a 3-year project. We met every summer and then met a couple times during the year to criticize each other's work and so on.
Okay, I really want to jump into 66, but let's, I don't want to jump ahead, how you became
part
a governor.
Of that.
It
was clear that the Home Loan Bank Board was in trouble, and somebody approached me and said, would you be willing to be on the Home Loan Bank Board? And I was sort of dubious. I was going east, and they said, well, you have to go and talk to them in Washington. It's really your duty. This is a very weak place that needs somebody. Needs a good economist. So I did, and they said, oh, you're just what we're looking for, and so on and so forth. And, anyway, I was processed through the FBI and thought that I was going to be on the Home Loan Bank Board. And then it turned out that I was just ignorant of the whole thing. I knew nothing about politics. But basically, the savings and loan industry didn't want a strong person on the board, so I was vetoed politically.
And the other board members were afraid of an economist?
Not one of the board members, it was the industry.
Okay.
And they had veto power politically, basically. So that suddenly I found a very weak guy had been appointed to the bank board, and forgot about Washington for a couple of weeks, and then the White House called me, actually, the Council of Economic Advisors, and said, would you be interested in being on the Federal Reserve Board? I sort of said, well, who are you kidding? If you just passed me over for the Home Loan Bank Board.
So by this time it was Ackley, or was it still Heller?
It was Ackley. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he said, no, we're serious. And he said, let's talk. And we talked on the phone for about half an hour or so. And then he said, well, wait a minute. And he called me back in about 2 hours. And he said, well, can you come to Washington? And I said, yeah, I'm running a conference in England next week, but I can come. 2 days, he said, no, take the red eye. So I went in and talked to the president for an hour or so, and he said, have you ever met Bill Martin? I said, no. He said, well, we're swearing in Fowler as Secretary of the Treasury at noon. Why doesn't Martin come over and meet you here? He's going to be here anyway, so you can talk. And I said, okay. So Martin and I talked for half an hour, and then we were going into the swearing in. Martin said, well, we better not go in together because people wonder who you are and stuff if we do. So he went in one door and I went in another and was just standing in the back, and suddenly Johnson says, I have an announcement to make. And he brought up a piece of paper and read my bio and said, this is, I'm sending his nomination to the Senate.
What kinds of things did Johnson want to know about you?
Mainly he was interested to know I had just beaten a recall election for the Berkeley School Board, so he was interested in the fact that I had been through a couple of political campaigns at that level.
That must have seemed funny to him.
I'm told, I don't know whether it's accurate or not, but people have told me that actually the night before that, he had gone to bed with two or three files, with mine and a couple others who were being considered for the board, and had picked my name out of the three, and then just wanted to confirm his.
So presumably Martin had looked at the selection of files before. Martin knew who you were.
Yeah, he knew who. Well, at least Martin told me at one time that he thought he could have vetoed anybody in the list, but that he didn't feel it was his function. That if the person was qualified, he didn't feel it was his function to try to veto it. That if he had raised a storm, he could have stopped any announcement. And the same thing I'm through. Sure was true of Brimmer, that he didn't want Brimmer there, but that he didn't feel it was his function to fight a qualified person.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that Martin had a preference for non-economists on the board, or at least a skepticism toward economists, or did you not feel that that was just a story? That?
Well, I'd put it the other way. Ask about what Martin's view was. Mm-hmm. And Martin's view very clearly was that what was important was the way the market was working.
Sure.
And that you got a feel for the market. You didn't have to know anything about it. But he was on the other. Now, when I went in, still as a result of Jung, there was a rule against any forecasting at the board. Jung simply had a thing, he'd fire anybody who made a forecast, basically. So there was a strong rule. Well, I went to Martin and in effect said, you know, these economics are terrible. We've got to do more. And sort of the Green Book came out of that.
And the first Green Book came out in November 1965.
Yeah, but then it still had no forecast. The first forecast would have been sometime during in 66, mm-hmm. Partly as a result of there was a big fight during, you know, the first half of 65 where the discount rate had gone up, but reserves were going up rapidly, and the money supply was growing rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought in effect, the proviso clause came out of that.
Well, a number of the staff members retired about that time. Riefler, of course, had already retired,
yeah.
and Thomas, and then Young, and then but Brill was a kind of continuity between the older and younger generations.
Right,
and Brill.
And the before Brill, right after, let's see, Thomas, I think, was still there the first month or two. I came. Let's see, I came in May. I was sworn in, I think, May 1st, '65.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah. So that's when the Green Book came after that. There was a man in between them who left after a year or two to become chief economist for Morgan Bank.
I think of in a minute, I know who it is. And then there was a number of younger staff members who came in at that time. Well, they'd been there, but they moved up to positions, Axelrod and Partee and Ramley and Pierce later on.
But Holland and Partee were the two main ones.
Holland.
And the guy at the mortgage banker. All three of them became governors.
Ramley,
yeah. Those three came up with Brill, or Brill was above them, but then Holland, in effect, became co-equal. Maybe Partee did, I forget how, but those four would have been the ones who took under sort of the new regime of the...
Mm-hmm. You felt that they were all competent as economists.
Yeah.
And so you felt that at that time the board and the staff changed. There was a change from the old guard to a new guard, and that it was
right.
Positive.
Well, yeah. As I say, there was the fact that the Green Book then had forecasts, and beyond that, you had the Blue Book, which supposedly showed what the effect of money would be. When I came to the board, there had been a so-called directive committee, which was a joint committee of governors and presidents of some of the banks. And I think Mitchell was chairman, and I know Swan from here and Frank Morris were members, and there were probably a couple other governors and things about. And theoretically, that directive committee was to develop a theory of what the board was supposed to do.
Yeah, there was a credit proxy added to it.
They say a proviso.
Yeah, right.
But that was so there was a recognition of a lack of theory. Mm-hmm. Well, again, because the board was under lots of academic criticism. From starting with Friedman, but Bruner and Meltzer were the chief ones, and in effect the system was reacting to that criticism.
But even so, I mean, your goal as a governor was to bring some rationality to decision making, to have clear objectives and right. a clear strategy for going from the policy variable yeah. to objective. So you must have brought that with you.
I was the first academic economist since Miller on the first board. And I think mm-hmm. Mitchell may have been the first economist.
Yeah, I think Miller right. taught at Berkeley too.
Yeah, he did.
In the early 1900s. Yeah.
Right. But I think Mitchell was the first economist then appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And then came Dean. But then I was the first academic one with a theoretical background. Mm-hmm.
But perhaps this jumps ahead, but neither Martin nor Burns were at all interested in having analytical procedures where you work back from an explicit objective. They were willing for you to work on the directive, but neither were sympathetic to the kind of systematization of procedures that you wanted to pursue.
I'm not sure. I've always admired Martin for this. When Burns's appointment was announced,
mm-hmm.
and there was going to be about a 6-month interregnum, there Burns was in the White House.
Right.
I think his appointment was announced about 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. I went to Martin and said, I realized the first year I was here, we had lots of arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that, or at least part of it, was that the board has its own language and systems that you knew and I didn't know.
Right, yes.
And therefore, it took a year or more for me to...
Yeah, you talk about that in your book, yeah.
...really understand. And I forget, I didn't realize I had it, but then I suggested that I be appointed sort of a liaison with Burns, or at least a committee to explain to Burns what the things meant and so on. And that was, again, outgrowth of, I think maybe at that point I was already chairman of the directive committee or something.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that was a committee or whether it was an ad hoc committee, I don't remember at this point. But I think as a result, when Burns came in, mm-hmm. he knew a lot more. He was surprised how, again, little he knew.
That's right. I mean, he had never studied financial markets in the way he'd studied real markets.
Right.
So in terms of the housing market, for example, or kind
yeah.
of...
Yeah, but he also just didn't quite... He thought he knew what the board did, but it turned out I think he didn't. And the other surprising thing, again, I don't remember whether it was in the book or not, was that Martin was willing to take the responsibility and effect of acting in his last meeting to take some of the pressure off Burns. But when Burns came in, then we had a directive drafted in terms of reserves and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well. Okay, why don't we jump back to, and then work forward from fall of 1965.
Right.
So obviously we need to start with the discount rate increase.
Right.
Martin had been telling Johnson since September of 65 that he thought interest rates needed to go up.
Right.
But Johnson had his gallbladder operation, and there was a lack of communication. And in fact, later on, by November, Martin had already started moving interest rates up. The funds rate had started moving up, at least if you look at the series. The discount rate hadn't moved, but the funds rate was inching up.
Yeah, right. But the critical thing was there was a basic argument. It was clear in the board that it was 3-3 with Dean Dewey in the middle, it wasn't clear how he was going to jump. And in the both the Treasury and the Consul felt very strongly that there had to be a more anti-inflationary policy, but they thought two things. One, that they could convince Johnson to go for tax increase. Mm-hmm. And they very much preferred that because you still had a wage price policy, and they were afraid that if the interest rate broke, then there was no way of keeping wages down. In other words, if a major price move came from the money side, that would bust their whole policy.
But on exactly the opposite side, I mean, some of the governors felt that it was inappropriate for banks not to be able to raise the prime rate as their cost of money rose. So some of the governors wanted to raise the discount rate as a way of taking the heat off the banks.
That argument wasn't made, no. Okay. As I say, the basic argument was one of, do you want to tighten, but more than that, how do you want to tighten? Whether you want to do it through fiscal policy or monetary policy. And because of the administration felt that the fiscal policy was a much better way of doing it, and also that they felt that if you tried to do it through the interest rate, you would bust the whole wage price thing wide open, they were arguing that it ought to go through fiscal policy, and that they couldn't convince Johnson to go for a tax increase. And Martin was simply convinced that you couldn't. And in effect, when Johnson was stuck on the ranch, I think Martin saw this as his opportunity to be able to do it. And he convinced Dean to go with him rather than with the Treasury.
Let me ask you this about Dewey Dane. In reading the minutes when he was a governor, I mean, he seemed to always side with the chairman. So was it really a question of...
Well, after that he did, but there
was a time before.
There was a time before when it was unclear. In other words, I would say it took Martin a month or two longer than it would have taken him to convince Dane. Because he had come from the Treasury and he still felt some loyalty to the people who had gotten him appointed.
Right, so he was in transition between the Treasury and the Fed. That makes sense. What about Mitchell? He was an economist from the Chicago Fed. Was he a business?
Director of Finance in Illinois under Stevenson.
He'd been part of the Stevenson campaign in the 50s, and then he had a position when Stevenson was
governor of Illinois. He was director of finance, and then then he must have gone back to the Fed, or he may have gone to the Fed from that. He may have been at a bank and then gone with Stevenson.
Yeah, I should find out. Usually Fed people don't get involved in political campaigns, so I'll have to find out.
Well, as I said, I'm not sure whether Stevenson appointed him from the Fed or whether he'd been a bank. He may have been in one of the Chicago banks. Mm-hmm.
Was he a business economist or a regular Keynes? How would you characterize his economics?
He was primarily a tax. He came out of the budget tax.
Oh, I see. So even though he was director of research at the Chicago Fed, he was not trained as a academic-style economist?
I don't think he would have had to have been at that time.
Did you find him easy to talk to in terms of his economics?
Oh, yeah. But again, as I say, at that point, you had Mitchell and Dane as economists, but both who'd come from the system, and neither who had kept up really with what was happening in terms of where the field was going.
Right. How about Robertson? He was a lawyer, and
yeah.
He'd been in the system since 1952. He'd been something of a populist originally. What was his thinking?
Well, he was, I would have said it would have come out of the Nebraska populist.
Broken
on the other hand, in terms of regulation, he was overly strict. I fought with him all the time because he had been deputy controller of the currency. Had been in the regulatory function there, so his background was primarily regulatory. And in there, he, you know, there was the whole problem that the controller now had become far more liberal in regulation.
James Saxon.
Okay. And he, in effect, Robertson was fighting him. And again, I don't, this is background, I don't think you should report this, but okay. I had a big fight with Robertson over several issues relating to regulation. And finally, I forget at what point, I won, and Bill Martin thanked me. The point was that any time if Martin had wanted to do it, he could have gotten it over. But really, his whole view, I think, was that he had so many chips and they weren't to be spent.
So was this over Regulation Q in 1966?
No,
it was over
functions of banks.
And allowable activities.
You know, and Martin could have, because it was finally balanced, because as I said, I forget who it was who finally made the difference and would listen to me instead of Robertson. But at that point, Martin said, well, you were obviously right, we should have done this a long time ago and so on. But he could have done it if he had spoken out for me.
He let you carry the water. Yeah.
Yeah.
Later on, Robertson pushed for, by the end of his term as governor and under Burns, he generally pushed for a restrictive monetary policy. So perhaps he changed by the end, or he just thought inflation was more of a problem.
Yeah, I think so. But as I say, when I came, he had been the strongest low interest rate, but I think it was from a low interest rate point of view that high interest rates were bad for farmers and things of that sort.
The broken bow, Nebraska. What about the other two governors on the other side, Shepperson and Balderson? Were they strong figures, or did they follow the chairman?
Balderson was a fairly strong figure. Shepperson was not. He was an agricultural economist and had been dean of agriculture at Texas A&M or something like that, and didn't really have much to offer at all. Wallerston was a strong guy, but he was not an economist. His field was management, and he'd had business experience as dean at Wharton. He had been on a couple boards and things of that sort.
You must have known then President Swan, who was at San Francisco.
Well, I hadn't known him.
You hadn't known. Were there any strong presidents, not as strong as the governors?
No, there weren't. Hayes in New York was fairly weak. The strong ones was Swan and Morse and the guy from Philadelphia.
It was Bope and then...
Bope and then Eastburn.
David Eastburn.
Bope was.
Yeah.
Then the guy from Atlanta
Bryan?
Bryan was sort of a populist type of thing. The man from Texas was a...
Watrous Irons.
Oh, yeah, no, Iron was a... He was from Alabama. Was he the Alabama one? Yeah.
Well, he was the... He was from the Dallas Fed.
What was he? No, because Stewart or somebody like that. There was a... Well, maybe that was a little later.
Yeah.
There was a guy...
Caldwell replaced Irons in Texas.
Well, then I thought Stewart was...
So, Martin must have been surprised at the reaction from Johnson over the discount rate.
Uh-huh.
Increase. He knew there was going to be a storm.
Well, as I said, what I was surprised at was how rapidly it was done.
You said there was no preparation at the board meeting, no discussion.
It was an emergency meeting, and there was no paper or anything. It was just passed. No discussion.
As soon as Dane got back from Florida and could be there.
I don't remember. And Johnson wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Martin goes to the ranch. Ackley said he had a long walk with Bill Martin, and they had a congenial conversation. So at that time, Ackley must have explained to Martin his strategy for trying to dampen the expansion with fiscal policy, with the tax.
It was on for...
So they've been conversing for...
Several months.
Some time.
Yeah.
Did you have contacts or conversations with members of the council at that time?
Yeah, with Ackley and Oaken. Mm-hmm. Forget at what point Oaken took over, but they...
Oh, I think it was the beginning of 68.
Was it so? Was Ackley that whole time? You know, but anyway.
Yeah. But then, after that, in early 67, Martin kind of pulled back. In fact, Martin was not aggressive about...
Well, you know, there was this big fight in June, July,
early
and 66 August of 66.
That's what I mean, early 66, yeah.
Yeah, there was a fight within the board, because at that point, everybody agreed then that you ought to use monetary policy, and yet the question was, well, given the rate at which the money supply was expanding, were you using it or not? And that was when the whole question of the open mouth policy came back.
Right. But wasn't there an odd flip-flop between positions that the move toward higher interest rates in that summer was led by the liberal members of the board, Maisel, Bremer, and yourself, and Robertson signed on to that also.
Right.
That Martin was in the hospital in July.
He was, I don't remember. Yeah. But as I say, the question was the rate at which reserves were growing,
mm-hmm.
and so on, and the argument, therefore, that you weren't being restrictive, that if you were, interest rates were going up, but they weren't having the effect you expected, because the money supply was, and bank credit was growing at such a rapid rate. That's what led to the letter.
Mm-hmm. Did you yourself ever feel like you were under pressure from the administration? Did anyone ever call you and complain about high interest rates, or you said you were supported by the council over this period. Tell me about the divisions over Regulation Q. The board raised Reg Q in December when it raised the discount rate, and
that was primarily Mitchell's interest.
He felt that Q
should be out. That it was a hindrance rather than a help.
But even though Mitchell voted against the discount rate increase, he was in favor of the increase in Regulation Q.
Right.
Because he was concerned that the money market cost of funds, the banks, was rising.
Well, he thought you were putting it up that it just oughtn't to exist. That it,
mm-hmm. So did you argue with Mitchell over that issue? At that time it was not.
No. As I say, the theory, it was raised so high, in theory, to get, mm-hmm. get it out of the way so banks would make their own decision.
But then starting in the spring of...
Well, then the board came under pressure from Congress, from Patman, particularly, mm-hmm. because the SNLs were in trouble.
Did you hear from the Did you yourself hear from the California SNLs at that time? I mean,
yeah.
They had.
Well, they came in to see Martin, and Martin asked me to be with them once when they came in. And in effect, the answer was that we really can't do anything about your problem. That you can't put the gene back in the box after it's out.
But the Californian SNLs were the ones with the major problems because they had attracted
money from all over,
I guess what later became known as hot money.
Right.
So they were hurting the most. Of course, Patman just wanted lower interest rates.
Right.
Well, did he ever get to the point where there was some threat that he could have legislated a low rate of interest
right.
that banks could have paid in all their deposits?
Well, that he could have forced Q back.
And so there would have been a major disintermediation
right.
from the money center banks.
Yeah.
And was it that threat of congressional legislation that got the board over its differences between Reg Q and got them to support...
They coordinated policy, you set up under... I guess it was under legislation, that you had, in effect, you couldn't move Q without a discussion with the other financial agencies.
Yeah, especially the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and
right.
the FDIC.
And that was the compromise with Patman, in effect.
How did the board split over that? My recollection is that the board was split on that issue and Martin didn't want to enforce a uniform position, so when there was the governor's testified
before Congress with different positions on Reg Q. Yeah. I had no thoughts whatsoever about it.
Whose idea was it to have differentiated ceilings, to have a somewhat higher ceiling for the SNLs than for the banks?
Well, as I say, that was part of, I think, the compromise with Patman.
And so that idea presumably came out of the SNL industry?
Yeah, out of the SNL and out of Congress.
That wasn't your idea.
No.
You weren't a key.
No.
I thought perhaps because of your interest in the California SNLs, perhaps you brokered the arrangement between. So congressional relations were handled the way they're handled now between Martin or the chairman and a congressional liaison. Primarily, the governors didn't get involved with talking to Congress.
I was friendly with the California delegation, but I don't remember any. It was usually the other way that I was trying to sell them on what the policy.
You were trying to explain the Fed's
Fed policy to them. Dick Canna, as I recall, was the California member on the Banking and Currency Committee. It was pretty powerful.
So Patman had support on congressional legislation to impose a 4% ceiling on the interest on all bank deposits. But his other crusade to limit the independence of the Federal Reserve System, he never had broad support for that. So Fed independence itself was never under threat. It was just the Congress might
legislate a ceiling on bank interest rates.
Mm-hmm. And you felt at the time, and still feel like, that the Fed did the right thing, that that was the way to go.
Yeah. As I say now, whether if I had knew more about it and thought more about it, whether I would have been in favor of moving up a few as much as we did, I don't remember or know, but all I know is I hadn't really thought about it that much. It came as, it just wasn't anything. There were certain things, you know, that had never occurred to me. For example, when I was on the board a couple months, the guy I knew was chief economist for the New York Stock Exchange asked if he could bring his boss in and talk to me, and I said sure, and I came in and talked. And not until after the conversation did I remember that the board had anything to do with the stock exchange.
The margins.
Margins, things had never really come up.
Yeah. Then
and Q was sort of in that same category.
Then, of course, there was the credit crunch, and as you mentioned, there was this letter to try to get banks to ration credit to large corporate customers,
right,
rather than raising rates right, higher. And then,
well, it was more than that. There was a real threat that scared the banks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they acted on it.
Yes.
I mean, the threat was that if you come in for reserves and
in the discount window,
and you haven't followed in accordance with the letter, well, you may have trouble getting reserves.
And that was something that the council and the board worked out jointly as a way of mitigating the effect of high interest rates.
I'm sure the council would have supported it, but I don't remember that they. I think Berman and I were the two who primarily pushed it.
Mm-hmm. And then in September, the desk began to back off slightly on interest rates to move them down. There was presumably, I mean, it seems like at that time there was an understanding, or at least a hope, that if the Fed began to back off on interest rates and kind of back away from this policy that was falling heavily on housing, that Johnson would go for a tax increase in his January State of the Union address.
Well, as I say, I don't remember what the timing was, whether it was that year or the next year, because as I say, I do remember, you know, the agreement, and as I say, at that point I know I did some lobbying on the Hill. I had lunch with the whole California delegation and stuff, and to explain the theory. And I remember talking to Wilbur Mills about it. Johnson asked me to talk to Mills.
But
as I say, without going back over the records, I don't remember the exact timing of this.
Mm-hmm. But there was, at some point, there was an understanding between the council and the board that if Johnson could be persuaded to push for a tax increase, then you would have the substitution between the fiscal policy. You were in agreement with the council that fiscal policy should bear more of the burden of
and
a restrictive policy.
When the tax was passed, the board moved faster than it normally would to lower rates.
Yeah, that was.
But that was partly because the election was coming up. In other words, the board really had a policy that you don't want to do anything after by August. If you're going to take any action, you ought to do it at the beginning of the summer, no later.
Well, that jumps ahead, but there was also there was a lot of uncertainty over how much impact the tax surcharge would have, especially since it had been combined with significant expenditure cuts at that point, and there was a feeling that that monetary policy had to be the counterbalance. It had to encourage a flow of funds to housing, and that would take a, would, there would be a 6-month lag or so. And if the interest rate cut weren't taken promptly in early July of 68, then the economy could be in a recession.
Well, as I say, but it also was the fact that I think we would have waited for another month or so if it hadn't been trying to get out of the way of the election.
Let's jump back to, was Wilbur Mills, did he come across as a populist on interest rates, or was he more thoughtful?
No, I don't remember. But I say, all I know is Johnson had, it was, I'm sure, part of his general policy, but for example, on policies of that sort, he would have actually an open call. I don't know whether how many members of the board, but they called me, and it also at one point Johnson called and said, I've told Wilbur Mills you're my economist there at the board, will you go talk to him? And,
so this was in 66, over the
66.
Credit crunch,
that,
the credit crunch period when, after the discount rate. Increase. So you talked to Johnson on the phone once.
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
And once Robertson and I, he called us in that period.
And so
he was trying to put pressure on Martin. But this was after.
And that was to carry out this. Out of this came the strategy to try to mitigate the impact of high interest rates by with the letter. That's interesting. So presumably, well, as a fact, Johnson was talking to Martin at Quadriad meeting. So he just thought he needed.
Yeah, but that was an interesting thing. Again, I don't remember that was in the book or not. I was annoyed at Martin. He took the attitude, and apparently Greenspan takes it even more now, that he was on the Quadriad as an individual and not as a representative of the board, so that he didn't report to the board what was going on at the Quadriad. And he didn't ask for the board's opinion as to what he ought to say there. He felt he was there as a as an individual advisor to the president, not as a representative of the institution.
Well, maybe that was a sort of defense for Martin, so he felt like if he said he was representing the board, then if he took a position, he would be committing the rest of the board. Maybe he felt like he could, that gave him an out. He could say, well, gee, you know, I really can't commit on this one, but I'll go back and talk it over.
I don't know, but
he did not go back and talk it over.
Yeah, the board didn't have much impact, was the effect of it. As I say, I've told Greenspan it was the same way.
Well, Arthur Burns must have been the best example. So in early, well, let me ask you about Martin. Did you said there was this division on the board in 1965, which was finally resolved when Dewey Dane came over. In general, did Martin exercise control over the board in the FOMC in the sense that he pretty much always got what he wanted?
No, it was exactly the opposite. He only felt it was worth using his position at critical times. Otherwise, he always spoke last and bored. I never heard him speak first on anything except monetary policy. And even then, if he didn't think it was important, in other words, you only change policy once a year, really, or something like that, he would go for 6 or 7 months. With the policy, but then at that time in '65, when he wanted to change, he began talking earlier in the meetings. I think you'll find this in the minutes. And this is how the people who didn't know how to vote learned how to vote, because at that point he was doing it. But in, as I say, the example I gave in regulation, he never did, and he always voted with the majority. I'm sure you'll never find a vote that Martin isn't in the majority. This is because he voted last.
The only other
time that I thought he used his power, and again he had to change, was I started to push for reserves against euro dollars. Again, I don't remember when.
69.
When we started to push for it, I don't know, and introduced sort of resolution in the board and so on, saying we ought to have. And Martin never let that come to vote. He just kept it off the agenda. That was the only time I ever had with him when he used the control of the agenda for a policy. Now, it turned out later, and we did vote it finally. What happened was that I had some inkling of this, but really didn't know. Can't really say how clear it was. He met with the ten biggest bankers in the country, whether once a month or once every 2 months or something like that. And on the Eurodollar thing, he thought he had an agreement with them that if we didn't put in reserves, they would be reasonable in the amount of reserves, money they brought in that way. And then what happened, because this, he did come to me, and he said, called me last night and said that he has broken the agreement and he no longer can.
That sounds right. I didn't know that, but
he no longer plausible. Can stick with it. So we have to adopt the policy now.
Okay. Well, but
that don't quote, even quoted it in general terms, but not.
No
names, but.
Underneath Martin's kind of congenial, pleasant, homey exterior, I mean, he knew what he wanted, and he would move toward it, and if he had to retreat and wait to get it, I mean, do you feel like he was a very strong individual, or was he more of a consensus person?
But as I say, it was only really on monetary policy that he felt strongly. But he felt very strongly that he knew what was happening in the market.
Yes.
And that his theory of the market was the right theory. And he saved all of his efforts along those lines. In other words, on all the others, the questionable appointments of staff and stuff like that, he didn't take a strong view. And this, the only one along the other line that I can remember where he felt strongly was on that question of reserves on Q. And that was, as I say, it turned out was because he thought he had an agreement with all the banks that were involved. And there's a lot to say for that. There's a whole theory
of
that you're better off with the gentleman's agreement than you are with a regulation. That there, a regulation you can always get around, whereas if you agree to a general agreement as to what you're trying to do, you can't evade it.
So in 67, then the economy weakened, perhaps it was an inventory recession, that's what the staff said at the time.
Growth of recession.
And Martin, the unemployment rate didn't rise, but industrial production fell. And Martin pushed interest, or the FOMC pushed interest rates down fairly strongly. There was a feeling that a recession was unacceptable, and if the Fed made certain to the administration that it was not going to allow a recession, then There would be more of a likelihood of persuading Johnson to go for a significant tax increase.
Yeah, I think so.
And then in June of 67, when the economy began to strengthen again, and it was obvious to everyone, it wasn't just a prediction, and at that point, Johnson was unwilling to send a tax proposal to Congress, so the FOMC began raising interest rates at that point. Does that sound right?
That's part of the pressure, yeah.
And yeah.
What, but he must have been the, did he get his State of the Union in 68 ask for the tax?
No, he asked, he had asked for a tax increase in his State of the Union address in 1967, but he didn't send it to Congress.
Right.
And he didn't send it to Congress until August of 67. And then at that point, the economy was growing strongly, but the FOMC, most members felt that if they raised interest rates, then Congress would say, oh, we don't have to bite the bullet and raise taxes. The Fed has done the work for us. So there was reluctance at that time to raise rates.
They say, I don't remember the timing. I remember, mm-hmm. They say, I do remember spending some time on the Hill, the only real time I did, trying to get the text to explain the reasoning behind it all.
So earlier you talked about visiting Congress about Reg Q, but this was about the tax hike.
Yeah, and I talked to the the California delegation, and now I'm going to think of it, whatever the liberal caucus was of the Democrats, I forget what they called it.
So you presumably argued that, well, if we don't get a tax hike, the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates, and that'll have repercussions for housing, and so the California delegation must have been sensitive to that.
But
given
as I say, I then also took one, I forget if they had group in its name somewhere.
Excuse me?
I'm trying to think of what the caucus was called.
Americans for Democratic Action.
This was just kind of congressional. It was the first sort of so-called caucus where people put up, it had a staff and so on. You know, like the Black Caucus does now and everything. This was the first of them. It was the Liberal Democratic Caucus. And I remember the guys from California asked me to talk to the whole group of 75 congressmen or something like that. Why the tax increase would be better from a liberal point of view.
There were problems on the international front. The end of 67, the pound first came under,
I was appointed because the pound was under attack.
Because of an interest in international?
No, because of the fear that they had left the seat vacant and that Martin would use the attack on the pound as a reason for raising interest rates, and that they would feel very guilty if they lost, if interest rates went up by a lack of a vote.
So that's why they were in a hurry to fill fill the seat. Was it Mills' seat you were?
Yeah, it had been vacant for 3 or 4 months, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was what surprised me, that suddenly it was in such a hurry. But it was.
I see.
But that was the reason they just felt they'd be terribly embarrassed to be sitting there. But by the way, did what happened out of the country? Did the Senate act on Rivlin and Myers?
I think it's at the end of 67 and the end of 68, Martin was unwilling for the Fed, the FOMC, to raise interest rates because he was afraid it would put pressure on the pound, and if the pound fell, then speculation would spread to the dollar. You became very actively involved in international.
Not very, just a little on the gold thing. Right from the start, I had felt that we ought to get gold out of the system. And really, that was the only issue I had as much to do with international.
I remember in the minutes you criticized the decision to intervene in the Euro-dollar market.
That was for a different reason.
Because you were critical that we were doing one thing in the foreign arena, trying to keep the interest rate down in Euro-dollars through the BIS, deposit of funds in the Euro-dollar market. At the same time, domestically, we were working for a different objective. We were working for to try to restrain a strong economy domestically, and yet we were keeping interest rates down in the Euro-dollar market. At least that was the idea. I remember you were critical of that.
As I say, I don't remember that. The one issue I do remember strongly was the question of whether the Fed ought to use its funds at the request of the Treasury or not. And my feeling was that there ought to be firm commitments from the Treasury and so on, that this was this was an area of relationship that was equivalent to other similar issues, and the Fed had been independent and had its own view in those matters.
So was your objection more to the fact that the board was excluded from these discussions, or was it you thought in March of 68 that the dollar should have been devalued at that point? Or foreign central banks should have made a stronger commitment to revalue their currencies? You don't remember that?
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the split of opinion between the New York Bank and their directors and the they wanted a sharp rise in the discount rate at that time, and when apparently, I mean, it appears that Martin had come to an agreement with other central banks about coordinating rate increases domestically and abroad, and I can remember reading a memo that is in the files that Andy Brimmer wrote criticizing the New York Fed for kind of trying to second guess the board on that. Do you remember that debate? Or,
no, but sounds right.
Yeah.
I mean, there were always two debates with the New York, right? It was Hayes and whoever was head of the
Coombs.
Coombs.
Yeah.
Coombs always wanted to have a bear attack. He just loved the idea of a bear attack, and he was always eager. He'd recommend it every time.
Yeah, he wrote a book just to highlight the time he was allowed to coordinate a bear attack among the central banks. So you could tell it was the high point of his life.
Yeah. Well, that, as I say, and the fact that both Hayes and Coombs, we always did feel put much too much emphasis on the foreign thing in their votes and recommendations and stuff. I don't remember the specific.
Mm-hmm. What about the discount rate reduction in the summer of 1968? I mean, in general, the FOMC, at least the bank presidents, were reluctant. They wanted to actually see the economy weaken before pushing rates down.
Well, I was gonna say, that was,
you said it was a timing issue.
The timing issue was the critical issue.
So Martin basically relied on the staff forecasts, on their forecast that the tightening of fiscal policy would act to depress the economy.
Right.
And
right.
That we needed to go ahead.
As I say, I don't know that he would have been, but I think the board as a whole, at least in this case, felt that you couldn't take a chance of not doing it and not being able to do it because of the election. Mm-hmm. That you had to go with the forecast, even though under ordinary circumstances you would have waited.
Yeah.
But you didn't have time to wait.
When the FOMC began to tighten in 1969, I mean, initially, you know, that was a unanimous move. But then as the year went on, by fall of 69, then there were divisions again, and so on one side it would have been Mitchell and Brimmer and you feeling like we had pushed too hard, and that was one reason you wanted to get the FOMC to look at reserves as opposed to interest rates.
Yeah, I'd have to go back, I remember there was one period, and it was probably that was the only time I ever called my own press conference, and it was because I felt that the press was misreading the action of the board. Now, almost all the time I was on the board, I argued, there's always been this argument, you can't do things because you'll be misinterpreted. And I always argued that that was a terrible argument, that you ought to say what you're doing, and that they're so that you could do things and not do things because of fear of being misinterpreted. Anyway, at some point there, I felt that what was happening was being misread. And
that was all right with Martin. I mean, you presumably talked it over with him, and he felt comfortable with that. I mean, Burns would never have...
He didn't feel... I think he urged me not to do it, but felt I had the right to do it. In other words, and the board public relations staff called it and stuff.
So who was the equivalent to Joe Coyne then?
Joe was there, and then he was his assistant already.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the senior guy, remember his name. They were just the two of them.
Then when Burns came on in February 1970, in your book you say that was the most divisive of the FOMC meetings that you attended. I think you used the word bitter. There was a group that was watching market psychology and thought that until there was an end of the inflationary psychology, they just had to keep rates up with no reduction. And presumably that group would have been led by Hayes.
I guess at that point.
Do you remember anything from that initial meeting? How Burns established? I mean, he moved the. Move the committee. Do you remember anything of how he established his...
Well, I think we had a bare majority and stuff, but after that, I never had it with him, but apparently there were two or three of the bank presidents that he would call in and spend a day with, and putting pressure on them. But it was using his convincing personality and what have you, but he would meet with individual bank presidents, I know, for lengthy periods if he felt he needed it to convince them.
Why do you feel like he needed to maintain such control? Do you feel like he was negotiating with the administration over fiscal policy, and if the system had appeared divided,
I don't think so.
Would have been less effective?
No, he was always afraid of that. Mm-hmm. He always used to cite the fact that the consul was almost abolished, and he saved it, and it was almost abolished because they were split and talked too much and stuff like that. He always used that as an example of why it was important to have a unified view. On the other hand, he tried to censor the governor's speeches, and we didn't agree. He never would have gotten Robertson to agree.
Well, you had several governors with very strong personalities at the time. I mean, Robertson, as I understand it, would think out a position very carefully, and once he'd come to a conclusion on a position, then he felt like he, you know, it was right that he should stick with it. And I mean, Andy Brimmer was a fairly strong person.
Yeah, well, it was funny. He would drive Burns nuts. He would never understand why he, what it was about it that, that was driving Burns nuts.
In the minutes, it doesn't come across as though Brimmer is challenging Burns. Well, Brimmer's generally in favor of, was in favor of the low unemployment kind of expansionary policies that Burns followed. But toward the end, summer of 72, it did sound like Brimmer was.
I was gone by that.
Yeah, time. But it is. But he must have irritated Burns in some way, because
way before that, I've seen Burns stamp out of the room, and Brimmer sort of looking surprised at what did I do that caused him to get so mad.
So that must have been in meetings of the board, as opposed to the full FOMC. So Burns would he wasn't just a gracious. Urbane, witty sort of a person. He could lose his temper and become angry if he felt like he was being challenged.
As I said, Brimmer, several times I saw him, Brimmer didn't have any feeling for what it was that was getting Burns so mad.
He just wasn't sensitive to kind of the way things were were going. Well, that's interesting. But you had an equally strong personality, but you were more sensitive to Burns' feelings and would know when it was appropriate to push him and when not.
I guess so. I got along fairly well. At the end, I got along with Martin. Martin wouldn't, after the discount thing, Martin wouldn't talk to me for 2 or 3 months.
2 or 3 months?
Yeah.
That seems out of character with what one hears about Chairman Martin in terms of what a gregarious, friendly, affable sort of person he was.
Yeah, as I say, I don't, we must have had lunch together and stuff, but I had no discussion with him, I know. And then what happened, finally, there was a, he felt he had to write a letter, and I guess it was on that Q thing, and it had to do with whether we would be, the law would be passed forcing us to have lunch with the Treasury and the consul. In other words, whether they would have.
But you did that anyways, right? Well, but you began to do it in a regular.
Well, and but so in answer to that threat of the law, he sent a letter saying that we would do it and that the law wasn't necessary. And at that point, he came around to see me to get my agreement. We had a long talk, and we were friends again after that. But he felt, I think, that I had gone too far and stuff. In the testimony on the discount rate. Did you ever look at that testimony?
No, I haven't done that. Did you testify on that?
Yeah, we all testified.
Okay, then I have to get that. Yeah. Our library wasn't getting things then.
Yeah, it would have been in January.
Okay.
And it's what is the, I'm pretty sure the House Banking Currency Committee. And I think he felt I insulted him in that in my testimony. I was rather intemperate, perhaps.
Well, you expressed, I remember reading about it, you expressed the administration's point of view that it should have been coordinated. But let me ask you, also, this is jumping ahead, but one of your objectives, one of your goals, and I think it really ought to be the goal of every economist, is to move toward analytical procedures where you have well-defined objectives and some model that relates changes in your policy variable to misses in the objectives. But you also say it a number of times in reference to fall of 65 and also fall of 1970 and fall of 71 that you think the administration should set the objectives for monetary policy.
Right.
So if the administration sets the objectives and we have these analytical procedures, then does it follow that you think that Fed independence then is not concept?
No, I think the concept is that the Fed has the right to speak out mm-hmm. and criticize, but that having done so, if there's no groundswell or congressional support or something, that it ought to resign. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in November and December of 1970, when the standard forecasts for GNP for 1971 were 1050 and continuation of 6% unemployment, and the administration wanted to get the unemployment rate down by the end of the year to 5%, so they came up using Okun's law with 1065, and then Art Laffer ran a regression of GNP on money, neither seasonally adjusted. That's where I came in. I was a graduate student then. And you speak in your book rather derisively of
procedure for Schultz at that point, trying to show why this made no sense. In other words, I remember one I gave to, there was annual agricultural forecast.
Yes, and you debated Herb Stein.
Yeah.
That was in the book, yeah. That must have been fun to hear. It must have been kind of a big deal for you, but it must have been fun for the audience.
I don't know. Well, as I say, it was just so clear to me, because you could define money any way you wanted. And what I had was a table with M1, M2, M3, or maybe its various mm-hmm. versions, and showing that they varied by 10 or 20 or 30% in there.
Well, in fact, in both of those periods, fall of 70 and fall of 71, M2 was picking up well before M1 was.
Right.
And so if you looked at M2, policy looked like it was becoming expansionary.
Right.
But even so, then your support for interest rate reductions late in 70 and early 71, you base those on the fact that the administration had set this objective of 1065, and you thought that the system should support it since it was publicly stated.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I my reading of the Employment Act says that too.
Mm-hmm. But how do you, if Congress had objected, then since under the Constitution we're under congressional oversight. So if the banking committees had objected to that, then you would have felt differently.
I again would differentiate between the committees and votes of the mm-hmm. of the bodies. It would seem to be there you'd have to interpret whether you think the committees are mm-hmm. representative or not. I would never mm-hmm. automatically assume that the committee was representative.
Mm-hmm. And how do you handle the possibility that the administration might have been setting its objectives to further its own political goals?
Is that
the congressional check?
I think it has to be, a public debate. That's why it seemed to me that it's important that the Fed talk to the president directly and not through the Treasury. Sort of one of the things the independence means is that the Fed has a direct mm-hmm. channel to the president, not through others. But that, given that channel and the threat mm-hmm. to speak out and telling the president what it would mean if there was a fight, that you try to convince him. Mm-hmm. A changing policy that way, but you can't run two different policies.
Mm-hmm. So this gets to the coordination of fiscal and monetary
right.
policy.
Yeah.
Again, do you feel like Andy Bremer basically intellectually felt this sort of way? I mean, you were both had this Keynesian kind of background, and
I'm not sure.
Yeah. What about the... do you feel like Burns was a little heavy-handed with the FOMC toward the end of 70 and early 71? Or do you feel like that was appropriate given the clear articulation of administration objectives? I know the December 70 and January 70, well, January 71 meeting, for example, Burns pushed up the date by a couple of weeks and didn't let the FOMC discuss the Smithsonian Accord. There were other things, you know, the directives clearly were, I mean, the options A and B were clearly his choice. Or do you feel like...
I just don't recall.
I mentioned the January 71 meeting in particular because at the February meeting, you were scheduled to discuss the report that you and Swan and Morris had put together on reserve control, and Burns wanted to move in January to reserves control. He was under pressure from the administration to get money growth growing again by getting reserves growing, and there was a lot of opposition at that time to moving to reserve control without having the full report and not having the discussion. And didn't you dissent at the January 71 meeting on that basis? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember.
You don't remember that, that debate?
Well, I remember that the... No, I just have a feeling about the debate, but I don't remember the time of your...
Okay.
We met and, in effect, told the committee that if Congress was willing to go out on a limb to say that they would pay if necessary, then it would be a sound loan.
Yeah.
And since they weren't willing to do that, then we held that the loan couldn't be made.
In terms of individuals on the FOMC who were particularly effective or ineffective, Hayes led a group who attached a lot of importance to the international situation, but he read his statements, and so
yeah,
his statements didn't come, he didn't take part in the give and take that
followed up. Oh, but he wasn't. My feeling there was that there were quite a few presidents that you had to make an argument today that they could take back to their staff and come up and have a view the next meeting. You couldn't bring in something fresh and expect a certain number of them to have an opinion at that meeting.
On their feet, were Coldwell and Morris effective terms of presidents? So they were pretty strong.
Well, Coldwell didn't participate that much. Morris was always one of the stronger.
Swan from San Francisco primarily stuck to his statements?
No.
He would participate.
Yeah. Again, it's hard for me to say because I worked closely with the two of them on the
directive.
On the directive, and they obviously had lots of views and stuff on it. I worked with Galusha and Morris. We revised.
Yeah.
You now have a 203B or a 20. I put that, got that through, but on that. You know, both of them were very strong in terms of things of that sort.
You felt at the time that the committee would work better if the regional bank presidents were off the FOMC, that it was too large to be, and most of their expertise was sort of managerial in terms of running the banks.
Right, so plus a certain amount, and more now, but they didn't have as much as that. Would have had. I felt local knowledge was somewhat important, or could be more important,
that it's
useful. But on the other hand, if you didn't have a way of, the beige book is obviously a better way. There was no way of knowing beforehand what was whether they would have local knowledge on critical questions or not.
Yeah.
So that's a more useful function, but on the other hand, the book could be done without all of them there or anything.
Sure.
Maybe the people who drew it up or committee each time to to bring you, or maybe just the at that point the staff that would have it. But I think that the local knowledge is of some importance or some usefulness.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think?